Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on legal analysis when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, our Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And you know, that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and our politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin, in order to take away the people's right to property and to destroy those property rights. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and our property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. That's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. If you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. Doesn't cost anything, and that's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative. It's educational. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, last time we took a look at legal analysis, we started off by giving you some examples of what it is that an appellate court judge is looking for when he's doing his legal analysis. Now, there's a thing here called code pleading. Code pleading. Can you say code pleading, boys and girls? All right, here's what a code is. A code is a secret communication. So we're going to have to learn how to deal in these secret communications because the law is written in code. In fact, remember, in Isaiah chapter 28, verses 9 through 13, the biblical legal code is explained. Well, it's really not explained, but it's given to us, and then the explanation we find in Matthew chapter 13, verses 10 through 17. So when we put line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little, we can decipher the scriptural code. Now, in law, the law is written in code, and there's about 1 million lawyers here in the United States, about 1 million. Out of 300 million people, about 1 million, less than 1/3 of 1%, are lawyers. They're the lawyers, the politicians who make the laws, and the judges that interpret the laws. And these three occupations or professions have a lock on the code. They understand it, and the rest of us don't. So here at the law school, we start off by teaching our students the code. It's like learning how to read. There's a code in reading. There's a code in language, and it's called phonics. So in our public schools, we don't teach phonics. We teach look and say. We don't teach reading. We teach memorization. We teach children to memorize certain words. Then if they ever run across a word that they've never seen before, they can't read it. That's why Johnny can't read, doesn't know the code. So what we do here at the law school is we teach lay people how to read the code. And so what this does is it teaches you, the lay person, what the code is so that you can understand the law. And that way you can avoid more trouble than you can get out of. Now, the judge does the same thing. He looks at the code, that is, he looks at the charges, he looks at the facts, he looks at the transcript. Now, his job is to do a legal analysis and to decide whether or not this guy has been convicted properly or not. So, in doing that, he has to code plead the statute first. That's the first thing that we do, is code plead the statute. Now, if we look up the statute and we find that no statute exists, which is what we found in the EPA charges back in the 1980s, remember, against Atlantis Manufacturing, which Peter Watt pled guilty to, that didn't exist. The judge right away finds out, well, the guy's not guilty because there was no law for him to violate. How often does that happen? It happens all the time. The police are always charging people with crimes that don't even exist. They're not even on the books. For instance, today, there are 250,000 cases of vagrancy processed in the United States. Vagrancy in this country was declared unconstitutional in 1964. There are 250,000 people a year convicted for vagrancy. Many of those, probably most of them, plead guilty to vagrancy. There's no law against being poor, no law against being a vagrant. But people believe that there is, and for that reason they plead guilty to it. However, once in a while, some guy may plead not guilty, try the case, and then if the case comes up to a judge, the judge then dismisses in the interest of justice. He never tells the guy, hey, there's no law here, you've been falsely arrested and imprisoned. No, no. The judge works for the lawmaker of the state. He's not going to do that. That's up to you, the belligerent claimant in person, to go make your claim. And most people can't do it because they don't know what the law is. They don't know what their rights are. They don't know what the law is. They don't even know if there is a law. Now, how often does this occur? It happens every day. Every day. Our estimate here is that about 75% of the criminal charges brought against people in this country are illegal, unconstitutional, or they don't apply to that person in that circumstance, about 75% of the time. So about 75% of the time, most of you people out there could beat the charges if you knew how. But that does not mean that of the people that are being locked up in jail that there's been some mistake made. When a guy pleads guilty to vagrancy, he has fulfilled the terms and conditions of the law. One, intent, and two, act. One, the intent. He's poor. He intended to be poor. If he didn't intend to be poor, he would have got a job and made some money. Number two, he's poor or he's vagrant. He doesn't have this money in his pocket. And the statute says, thou shalt not be poor. Now, you can sit there and say, well, maybe he didn't choose to be that way, just circumstances happened. Well, okay, but he doesn't have $20 in his pocket, and he's walking around on the street, so therefore he shouldn't be walking around on the street, should he? He should be hiding himself someplace. Well, besides that, the law was struck down as being unconstitutional, so it's not against the law anyway, and so all these people that want to plead guilty to that law are pleading guilty of their own free will and volition. In fact, the judge asked them, has anybody coerced you, threatened you, or intimidated you in any way? Are you making this plea of your own free will? And everybody says, yes, okay, well, in that case, then I find you guilty of vagrancy, go to jail, don't pass go, and don't collect $200. See how that game is played? All right. Now, in code pleading, what we do is we go get a dictionary, and we take a look at the charges, and then we go look up the meaning of each charge, of each word in the statute to find out what its legal meaning is. It may well be that we're not guilty of the charge because of a change in the meaning of the word. For instance, if somebody said you're gay, well, being gay doesn't violate any law. A sodomite violates the law of God, but being gay doesn't violate any law. So oftentimes words change. Now let's take a look at some charges. I am accused of 18 things very commonly. So I'm going to read this list off to you. Here's what people say of George Gordon. They say, I'm a tax evader. I'm a tax cheat. I'm a fraud, a cult leader, foul-mouthed, vulgar, profane, pervert. I'm obscene, illiterate. I'm a thief, a cheat. I'm unlettered, ignorant, politically incorrect, a liar, a false prophet, and a blasphemer. That's 18 common things. Now, there's probably 18 more that I can't think of right now, but I'm commonly called that. Now, the truth of the matter is some of these things are true, and I would admit to freely, such as being vulgar. I never denied it. I'm vulgar, but I deny being profane. And I deny being a pervert, and I deny being obscene. Never claimed that I was literate. Now, as I go through the list here, I need to make a determination, well, which of these is against the law, and whose law does it violate? Maybe this is just a mere LaGuardia personal preference. Maybe I have violated the doctrine of the Catholic Church, but, you know, okay, but I'm not a Catholic, and so I really don't care. Maybe I violated the doctrine of the Baptists, or the good order of the Mormons, or the sensitivities of somebody else. But that doesn't make that a crime. Doesn't make it a violation of the law of God. Doesn't make it a violation of the law of my state. Now, as to being a cult leader, I'm going to take that one first, and I'm going to take my yellow marker here, and I'm going to talk about cult leader. Oftentimes, people will say, that Gordon is a cult leader. That's a cult that you're involved in. Students come here and say, my father-in-law said that I'm getting involved with a cult. Well, I don't know. Maybe I am a cult leader. Maybe I am a cult. Until I go look it up in the dictionary, until I go look it up in the law, until I go look it up in the Bible, I don't know. So let's do that. Let's code plead out cult and find out. So we start with the dictionary. So I started out with the American Dictionary of the English Language, written by Noah Webster in 1828. And I looked up the word cult, C-U-L-T. Doesn't appear in the dictionary. Isn't there? Well, isn't that something? So I'm accused of being a cult leader. And the word cult doesn't even appear in the dictionary, at least as far back as 1828. Okay, so then I said, well, let me look it up in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, and let me see if there's a legal definition to this word cult. And I looked it up in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, and it's not a legal word. It doesn't appear in Bouvier's 1914 dictionary. Now, this is important because in the United States, it is the Bouvier 1872 dictionary adopted by the Congress of the United States as the official definitions of legal words in this country. So in looking at the 1914 edition, which is vastly expanded over the 1872 edition, the word doesn't appear. So I'm not in violation of any law here so far. Now, the word cult is pretty common in our vocabulary today. It's a derogatory term. It is a word of reproach. It's a word that when you attach it to somebody, it's like the word nigger. It's supposed to generate adrenaline in your veins and get you really excited, angry. It's to identify somebody as being wicked, evil, somebody that's subhuman. It's bad, wicked, terrible, awful, evil, to be in a cult or to be a cult leader. So I thought, well, let's find another dictionary. So I looked up the Webster's New World Dictionary, the 1966 edition. I found it. Here's cult. So it's a fairly recent word. Didn't occur in 1828. So sometime between 1828 and 1966, the word cult, C-U-L-T, came into the English language. Here's what it says. Number one, it's a way of worshiping. System of religious rites. A cult of snake worshippers. Two, a fashion or belief that a number of people are enthusiastic about. The cult of sunbathing. So the word cult generally applies to religion, but it doesn't have to. You could be a sun worshiper and be a cultist. You could be a surfer and you would belong to the surfing cult. So the word cult applies to a wide variety of activities, not just religion. Now, in looking up cult, we have looked it up as cult identifiers. Religious organizations, government agencies, and cult awareness groups have divided religious groups into three types. They are churches, or denominations, sects, and cults. So you've got churches or denominations, sects, and cults. The major difference between the three is in the membership, acceptance in the dominant culture, and the length of time that the organization has existed. All right, so let me underline acceptance in the dominant culture. Well, in 1878, polygamy was not accepted by the dominant Christian culture. The dominant culture said, we don't want polygamy. So the Mormons, who were a minority, they were not the dominant culture, they were a minority, were put upon by the majority. And the majority went into the halls of Congress and enacted a law. But it didn't violate the law of the Bible, it didn't violate the law of God. For instance, Jacob had four wives, David had six wives. There are 24 examples of polygamy in the scripture. Abraham had three wives. Polygamy comes in two forms. It can be polygamy, P-O-L-Y-G-A-M-Y, or polygamy, P-O-L-Y-G-E-M-Y, to describe two varieties of polygamy. One of them is accepted by the dominant culture today. That's polygamy, spelled G-E-M-Y, and the other is rejected, G-A-M-Y. I would venture a guess and say that the average Joe Sixpack doesn't know the difference. But the legal analyst must know. The judge has to know the difference between polygamy and polygamy. Furthermore, he should also know polyandry. And that's where you and I are. We have to determine polygamy, polygamy, and polyandry by doing our code pleading first. And so we code plead this out by looking up the definitions of the words. Then we need to find out, well, how is this cult used in the dominant society, the dominant culture? Now, the Catholic Church, Mormons, Lutherans are examples of churches or denominations. These are the major players in the religious arena today, and many of what today are considered denominations are just the legitimized descendants of sects. Sects are splinter groups from different churches and or denominations who have various philosophical and or organizational differences from the mainstream that they broke away from. Many Pentecostal groups fit into this category, as do the small, non-affiliated Neo-Baptist churches in rural America. Cults are at the bottom of the heap. Cults are groups that are so small and or so radical that they cannot be given the legitimacy of sect status, or large groups that are almost nothing more than a cult of personality devoted to a specific individual. All major churches, denominations, and sects started out with cult status when they were founded. Well, now let me underline that. They started out with cult status. So when Jesus started out, you know, the new Christian religion, he was a cult. He was a cult leader who had 12 apostles, later developed into 120. Then it reduced down again to 12, and then it expanded out to 3,000, and then, you know, here you have it today. So Jesus was a cult. Isn't that special? So somebody comes along and says, well, that George Gordon is a cult. Well, so was Muhammad when he started out. So all of you Muhammadans then are the net result of a cult from a cult leader named Muhammad. Isn't that special? Makes you feel real good, doesn't it? And Jesus, for all you Christians out there, was a cult leader. Okay. Now, with that out of the way, then, this definition of cult, however, has been recently expanded from the purely religious to the semi-secular. Now, while most cults do have a mystic tradition, the cult that is purely religious is not so much in the news these days as is the new style cult. Now, there are a number of traits that have been passed down by various cult awareness groups to identify these new style cults. Now, I want to underline traits that have been passed down by various cult awareness groups. So there are groups of people out there that call themselves cult awareness groups. These are self-appointed vigilantes who make the determination that you are or are not a cult. Now, Jesus and Christianity was, when it began, a cult. Jesus was a cult leader. Muhammad was a cult leader. Buddha was a cult leader. All of the religions started out as a cult, by definition. So now, as a judge, as a legal analyst, code-pleading cult identifiers, we're trying to determine if George Gordon is a cult leader and the head of a cult. I'm accused of that. I'm a cult leader. This is a cult, I'm told. Who says so? Well, various cult awareness groups. Well, who are these various cult awareness groups? Who has authorized these people to make this evaluation? Is it the Congress of the United States? Is it OSHA or the EPA or the IRS? Who determines this? By whose authority? Well, as it turns out, it's just, well, anybody that decides that they want to pass judgment on somebody else. That's what it boils down to. I can be a cult awareness group, and you can be a cult awareness group, and so can anybody else. We can just go around branding people as cults. There isn't any standard. It isn't that the Supreme Court of the United States says this is what a cult is and here's what a cult isn't. It isn't determined by the Congress or by the legislature of your state or by your city council or by your county commissioners or by the archdiocese or by the church or anybody else. It's just cult awareness groups. And we don't know who these cult awareness groups are. I tried to find cult awareness groups, couldn't find any. So if you're one of those cult awareness groups, send me an email, would you, and identify yourself. Tell me who you are so that, hell, we can identify you. Hey, that's a cult awareness group over there. Now, there are usually... There are usually some standards that we use here. These cult awareness groups, or whoever this is, comes up with some standards. Now, here's what they do. They've got 8 criteria that we follow to identify a cult. So here's what they are. There is usually one supreme leader. When there isn't a supreme leader, the vast majority of the time, it's a husband and wife shared leadership. Okay? So you, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, could be a cult because you and your wife have a shared leadership. So if you and your wife are operating a motel called the Six Rivers Motel, you could be a cult because the Six Rivers Motel is a shared husband and wife leadership. I don't make these rules. I'm just reporting them to you. Now remember, we're judges and we're making a legal analysis here. Number 2, the supreme leader is highly charismatic. So, lady, if your husband is a good salesman and sells people things like encyclopedias or insurance policies, and you and your husband are operating an insurance agency, and your husband is, or you are, a good salesman, and then your husband may be charismatic, that could be a cult. That would be the local shelter insurance agent and his wife. Next, number 3, the supreme leader and his way are presented as the only answer to his followers' problem. Well, that fits shelter insurance. Those insurance agents will tell you plainly, we are the only insurance company that can do the job for you. All the rest of them out there are no good. Number 4, the cult controls or attempts to control all aspects of its followers' lives. So this cult, the insurance agency, shelter insurance, attempts to control all aspects of its followers' lives, such as drive 55, buckle your seatbelt, and if we catch you, we'll double, if you have an accident, we'll double your premiums. Number 5. The cult usually discourages any and all family contacts and or ties unless said family members are also members of the cult. Don't have anything to do with mom and dad because they've got Allstate insurance. You have shelter insurance. Don't deal with people. Don't have anything to do with people that don't have shelter insurance. Number 6. The cult is usually isolationistic, and this can be physical isolation or simply social isolation. This could apply to religion, it could apply to insurance, it can apply to just about anything, a motel operator. Isolationistic? Social isolation? Does that mean if you're a farmer and you live out in the country, you know, you're a farmer and you live out in New Mexico and you've got 10,000 acres and you're a cattleman, are you a cult because you're socially or physically isolated? Number 7, the cult is usually destructive. This can be physically destructive, as in various guerrilla movements, socially destructive, as in groups that attempt to destroy the social fabric of any organized or semi-organized resistance to their ideas. Could this apply to the Mormon Church? And or personally destructive, such as the Scientologists' efforts to destroy the lives of people or former members who have crossed them by lawsuits or such other legal action. Or any given cult may use any or all of these tactics to prevent its followers from straying and to forestall any interference in its appointed mission, that is, selling more insurance or converting more members or. Number 8, the cult usually conceals or attempts to conceal its true nature from both outsiders and all but the leadership in the cult. A cult's true purpose is the personal aggrandizement of the supreme leader, whether it be in terms of power, wealth, sex, etc. The cult is there to fulfill all of the wishes of the supreme leader. Now, not all new style cults will have all of these traits, which is why they are said to usually have a certain trait. However, the presence of 6 or 7 of these traits will usually result in the tag of cult being thrown on a group, and all the news media has to have is 3 or 4 of these 8 traits from a non-accepted church, denomination, or sect, and then the news media throws out the tag of cult. And this can be misleading because most sports teams and elite military units have traits 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. So if we were to look at 1, 2, 3, 4, and trait number 6, we would find that the Chicago Cubs or the Army Rangers would fit the cult identifier. Now, as to whether or not George Gordon is a cult leader and I fit these 8, let's take our break right here and we'll be back and we'll take a look at legal analysis and code pleading applied to cult and see whether little Georgie Gordon is a charismatic cult leader leading an infamous Gordon cult. Right after this. You are listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page and download that free general law CD package right there. All right, going on, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate by endorsing or recommending the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please remember our webpage, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about legal analysis and code pleading. Code pleading is that practice that we apply to legal analysis by taking a dictionary and taking a look at the words that are being employed so that we can make a determination as to whether or not this person did or did not do or was supposed to or was not supposed to do something. Code pleading is very important because oftentimes people plead guilty to crimes like vagrancy, and it's not a crime to be a vagrant. It used to be. There was a time in America when it was against the law to be a vagrant, but it's not anymore. But 250,000 people a year are charged with and convicted for, plead guilty to vagrancy, believe that they're vagrants, believe they're guilty, and that they should be punished, and they are. So the law provides for people that believe they're guilty and believe they should be punished, and you can do that. But the law also provides for people that don't believe they're guilty and don't believe they should be punished, and they aren't. And then the rest of us stand around and say, well, we don't understand why some people are being punished and other people aren't. Well, it's because that's the way the law is. I didn't make it that way. I'm just reporting to you that's the way it is. And so you can make up your mind as to what you want to do. And in order to do that, you need to have a legal education. And this is why God in the Bible insisted that everybody have a legal education. Now, we came along and said, no, we're not going to have a legal education. We're going to have a liberal arts education. Well, okay, that's what you want. So then you're legally illiterate, and then you get mad because the police and the prosecutors and judges and politicians pass laws, and you get real excited. I witness this quite often. You know, President Obama has enacted, with the Congress now, has enacted this new health care insurance program. They exempted religious objectors. I'm a religious objector. All the rest of you people have to pay the tax, shut up, and take the services. I don't. I'm exempted from it. And then you're going to come against me, and you're going to say, well, Gordon, you're some kind of an elitist. You're out here breaking the law. You're a criminal. You don't have your health national health identification card like all the rest of us, and you're going to get angry with me. You do that with other religious groups. You know, some people over here are exempt from military service. The truth of the matter is everybody has an out with military service, but you don't know what the out is. You don't know how to stay out of military service, and so you get caught up in it, and then you blame the rest of us because we're not. People get mad at the Jews because they can count. Now, the Jews are guilty of a lot of crimes, but counting isn't one of them. You know, just because the Jew over here can do his percentages and understands how to conduct business and buy, sell, and trade isn't any reason for you to persecute the guy or to ostracize him. It would do better if you would learn how to count, and then he couldn't take advantage of you. So I was 37, and I learned how to count. Now, I'm not mad at Jews because they can count, because I can count too. And so when the Jew proposes that he sell me a house with a mortgage and charge me 6% interest and tell me what a good deal it is, I say, well, thank you very much, partner, but I don't want to buy it. And I don't, and I'm happy. And he goes out and sells it to you, and then he takes three houses away from you and charging you interest, and then you get mad and call him a dirty Jew. Well, he's a Jew, but he's not necessarily dirty. We should look up the word dirty and find out, well, what is dirty? That's what code pleading is all about. So we use the language inappropriately. You know, we like to brag about our education, and we've got degrees from college, and you know, when you get right down to it, not very many of us really know what these words mean or how they're applied. But you can rest assured the judge does. Oh, that judge, he's not making a mistake. He's code pleading. He's doing his legal analysis. When he comes back with his conclusion, you can just about take that one to the bank. Judges make mistakes, no doubt about it. But boy, I'm telling you, it's rare. When you catch a judge making a mistake, now, you've done something. If you can catch an appellate judge making a mistake, boy, that's really, 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 really something. And if you can catch a federal judge making a mistake, they do 1% of the time. 1%. And that's at the district court level. Now, when you get into the federal appellate courts and you take a look at the number of times that the U.S. Supreme Court overturns a court of appeals, oh, I mean, you're going to find more hen's teeth than you're going to find appellate court reversals by the Supreme Court. Now, it does happen. It isn't impossible. It can happen. But it's going to be very, very rare when it does. Now, we're looking at the subject matter of cult here. Now, I'm called a cultist, a cult leader, and that the Gordon Law School is a cult. Now, I'm going to come forward and I deny those three allegations. I deny it. Now, based upon the analysis that we've done so far, let me go through my analysis. Number one, I deny that this school is a church. I deny that this school is 501c3 tax exempt. I deny that this school is any kind of a religious outreach. I deny that this school is a sect. I deny that this school is a denomination. And I deny that this school is a cult. All right, so I've made a categorical denial. I didn't plead not guilty. I demurred. And that's because some of what is said here is true. But some of what is being said here is false. And in order for you to sustain a conviction, you have made a statement that these eight indici constitute a cult. And I deny all eight, not one or two, not five or six, not seven or eight, but all eight. Number one, this school conducts no meetings, there is no leader, and there are no followers. There are no meetings, no leader, and no followers. Number two, it is true that I am vulgar, but it is not true that I'm charismatic. Number three, you have choices to make, and you are an adult. So when the statement is made, number one, there is usually one supreme leader, and when there isn't, the vast majority of the time, it's a husband and wife shared leadership. Leadership employs the assumption that there has to be an organization. And this is not an organization. This is not a corporation, a trust, a foundation, or anything else. And there isn't a leadership here. My wife and I own a sole proprietorship. So as a matter of law, number one is false. Number two, it may be argued that I'm highly charismatic. But you'd have to presume that I'm a supreme leader, and the supreme leader in this business is my wife and I, who have a shared ownership in the business. So it's not a supreme leader, it's a shared joint proprietorship as a matter of law. Number three, the supreme leader and his way are presented as the only answer to his followers' problems. I don't have any followers, we have students. Students pay money and come to school. That does not make the teacher a supreme leader. Number three, the supreme leader and his way are presented as the only answer to his followers' problem is not true. What we teach in this school is that there are choices to make. You are an adult. Make your choices based upon the information that you learn here. We teach alternatives. The income tax has an alternative called tithing. We teach both. Now go make a choice. Some people choose the income tax, some people choose tithing. You know, some people, like the Mormons, do both. Number four. Number four calls for the cult controls or attempts to control all aspects of its followers' lives. Well, as I pointed out, we don't have any followers here. Once you come to school here and you leave here, you don't come back again. You can if you want to. But, you know, once somebody comes to school, you don't even have to come to school here. You can do this by correspondence and telephone. Most people, when they buy a school here, they buy a school in British Columbia, Canada, and they never come to Isabella, Missouri to school. Those are not followers of the Gordon cult. They buy a product, they buy a good, they buy a service, they pay for it. And if they want to communicate, they call by telephone or email or snail mail, but they never come here. So number four, this attempt to control all aspects of its followers' lives, the choice you make will have an outcome. And we tell our students that the choices that you make are going to have an outcome. And you should be prepared for that outcome based upon the choice that you make. We don't tell people here what to do. It's not a part and parcel of the educational experience here from this law school. Number five, the cult usually discourages any and all family contacts and or ties unless said family members are also members of the cult. Well, I teach no membership in anything, and there are no memberships here. In fact, one of the first things that we teach people is that when you join a club, a church, an organization, you have a legal liability that attaches with your signature when you join that organization. It could be the National Rifle Association, Social Security. It could be the NAACP. Anytime you join some group or organization, the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, you have a legal obligation and liability. So we teach people that that's not very good for you, and that you'd be better off if you didn't belong to any of these groups or organizations. There is no membership here in the Gordon Law School, and there are no followers here. Everybody that leaves here is a leader, not a follower. And in the real world, you need to learn how to lead yourself instead of following your politician. You need to lead yourself instead of following your preacher. You need to lead yourself instead of following your banker. And that's what we talk about in the form of responsibility. If you're medically responsible, you don't need a doctor. If you're fiscally responsible, you don't need a banker. And if you're politically responsible, then you don't need a politician. And now, if you want a politician, a banker, and a doctor, you know you're certainly free to make the choice. But that's following the doctor, following the preacher, and following the banker, and we teach leadership, not following. Number six calls for the cult is usually isolationistic, and this can be physical isolation or simple social isolation. Well, hang on a minute here. We teach that social isolation over here, or isolationism per se, is a choice for you to make. I don't know if you should join the Republican or Democratic Party. I don't know if you should live in the city or in the country. I don't know if you should join the Baptist Church or the Mormon Church. We're not here to prescribe solutions. We're here to present facts. We present names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. And then we suggest that you make a choice based upon names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. We're not here to tell people how to live their lives. I don't know whether you should be physically isolated from the rest of society. I don't know if you should go up in the mountains and become a hermit. It's an alternative. People do that. We don't recommend it, and we don't discourage it. I don't recommend polygamy, and I don't discourage polygamy. I just explain it and then tell you to go make a choice. That's all. There's two sides to polygamy. There's two sides to a coin. In most cases, you're not getting both sides. The purpose for the Gordon Law School is to explain both sides of the argument and then let you go make your own choice. I don't know if you should vote for Barack Obama and the Democrats in the upcoming election. And so when you hear me talk about immigration, which is what we talked about last week, I took immigration off of the internet, several articles, and then I said, well, here's what's going on. Here's what the costs are. Here's what the outcome is. Here's when it got started. Here's what we've done in the past. Here's what we're doing today. I didn't tell you people how to vote. I didn't tell you people what to do or how to do it. I said, well, here's where it's at. And then I came up with what I think is the ultimate outcome to the immigration issue. I said, here's the way this thing's going to come down. If you sail this ship at 23 knots, full bore, into 5,000 square miles of icebergs, my prediction is you're probably going to hit an iceberg. If, in fact, you hit an iceberg, this ship will probably sink. And, in fact, the Titanic did. But, you know, Captain Smith had five messages in his pocket. All five of them told him exactly where the icebergs were located. Over 5,000 square miles of real estate, and he knew exactly where they were. He made a choice. He said, start up the next boiler. I think they had 12 boilers on the Titanic, three for each deck, or four. And they lit off another boiler. Now, they didn't have all of the boilers working. I think they had 10 out of 12 running. They were making 23 knots or something like that. And he just tore right straight, straight and level, straight hit. He had a choice to make, and he made that choice, and that's what we teach here at the law school. There are choices to make, and you need to make that choice. As to whether physical or social isolation is involved, we're not recommending it one way or the other. And am I physically isolated? I live on a farm. I live on a farm. I've got neighbors around me. I can identify Don Uchman. He's a neighbor. And Dale Smith, he's a neighbor. Am I isolated? I can walk over to Smith's. I can walk over to Uchman's. They can walk over here. We all have cars. We can drive over to each other's houses. I got a car. I can drive to Gainesville. I go to Springfield every once in a while. I don't think I'm socially or physically isolated here. I don't believe it for a minute. Now, you people living in Manhattan may say, oh, my God, that guy's physically isolated living on a farm. Well, boys and girls, there's a couple million more of us that are physically isolated. Are you sitting there saying that every farmer in America, everybody that's living out in the country someplace, is a cultist because he's physically isolated? Huh? I'd say wake up and smell a coffee. Number seven calls for, the cult is usually destructive. This can be physically destructive, as in various guerrilla movements, socially destructive, as in groups that attempt to destroy the social fabric of any organized or semi-organized resistance to their ideas, and or personally destructive, as in the Scientologists' efforts to destroy the lives of anybody who crosses them by lawsuits. Any given cult may use any or all of these tactics to prevent its followers from straying and to forestall any interference in its appointed mission. All right, I'm going to underline appointed mission, and we do. We have an appointed mission here. It's called education. Our educational philosophy here is to use the story and the scripture as the basis of our educational model. And the school here teaches construction, not destruction. And we teach work and the work ethic, not the non-work ethic. And we obey the law, and we do not teach disobedience to the law. And we follow the Ten Commandment model, not the Ten Plank model. We do have an appointed mission. Education. We do not educate by memorization. We don't think that that's the correct modality or model to follow. But that's a disagreement. That's not a cult. And then number eight, I publish eight schools, a web page, and a worldwide radio program. I don't have very many secrets here, and I don't have any leadership. We don't have any council. We don't have a board of directors. We're not incorporated. We don't have any legal entity. I'm it. I'm it. And I challenge you to name one member of the Gordon Law School cult. Name one member. So in number eight, accusing me of the cult usually conceals or attempts to conceal its true nature from outsiders and all but the leadership in the cult, boys and girls. The FBI, the CIA, and the NIS all have taps on my telephone. I think my local sheriff has a tap on the telephone, and I'm sure that Tom Klein does. On more than one occasion, I've had to call the telephone company and tell them, look, the telephone has got so many taps on it that it's interfering with my reception. Take some of the taps off. Double them up. There isn't anything private going on here. Rest assured that the government's watching my every move, boys and girls. If you can't trust your government, who can you trust? Now, I publish 8 schools. They go around the world. We're heard in 123 countries worldwide. Don't you think that the FCC in Vietnam is watching and listening? Don't you think that the FCC in China, Cuba, and Russia are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, trying to find out if I'm trying to subvert their citizens, trying to violate their laws? Well, I can't speak for Vietnam, Cuba, China, and Russia, but here in the United States, I know they are. There's no doubt in my mind. And just recently, I was turned in by my local prosecuting attorney to the IRS. How do I know that? He told me. I'm turning you in to the IRS. So, boys and girls, don't you believe for a moment that the Internal Revenue Service of the United States and my local prosecutor, Tom Klein and John Russo, and the local judges and the FBI and the NIS and the CIA and Homeland Security and God knows how many more agencies don't know all about George Gordon. There aren't any secrets here. These 8 indicia that identify George Gordon and the law school here as a cult is patently false. Patently. That is, it has absolutely zero credibility. None. Zero. Nada. But that doesn't mean that I will not continue to be a cult. Now, with that, I've got to remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.